This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Erlene McMichael talks with Southwest Michigan Black Heritage Society Executive Director Donna Odom. She tells us why the group is changing its name and mission. But first, the current United States Supreme Court term is nearing its end. A number of decisions on high-profile cases have yet to be issued, including the challenge to same-sex marriage bans in Michigan and other states. Nina Totenberg is legal affairs correspondent for NPR. She has been recognized many times with many awards over the years for her reporting on the Supreme Court. And Nina Totenberg joins us from Washington. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You have covered a lot of history at the United States Supreme Court. Where does this court case, the oral arguments, and now the pending decision rank in that history that you've had a chance to be witness to?
Well, I think this is right up there. I've covered a lot of historic cases, but June is the month in which the Supreme Court handed down the case of Loving versus Virginia in 1967, in which the court ruled that laws making it a crime for people of different races to marry were unconstitutional. And that was a huge decision, and it very much has come back reflected in the issues now in the same-sex marriage case. It's the case that is most often cited by those who are advocating for the right to marry among same-sex couples. And so there are lots of very big cases in the Supreme Court. So you don't want to ever say, if you cover the court, this is the most important, because always the most important seems to be the one you're covering right that minute. And then the adrenaline goes away, and it doesn't seem like such a big deal anymore 2 or 3 years later. But this is certainly a very historic moment in the history of the country and the court.
You mentioned that parallel to the Loving versus Virginia case. From the other side, for the people who are arguing that the Supreme Court should not strike down the ban in Michigan and other states, do people draw a distinction between same-sex marriage and the Loving versus Virginia case?
The argument that they make is that for virtually all of mankind's time on Earth, as long as we've had laws on marriage, until really only about 10 years ago, was the idea of same-sex marriage given any currency at all. It was always marriage between a man and a woman, that it's procreation that is the basis of marriage. Now, there are obvious answers to that, but that is the argument that advocates for marriage between a man and a woman only make, and for state laws that ban same-sex marriages.
There are, of course, some very high emotions running on both sides of this case, but when the justices sit down and consider this from a legal standpoint, what are the key legal questions they seem to be considering when it comes to same-sex marriage?
Well, the first question that was argued before the court is whether there's a constitutional right to marriage, meaning, in this case, same-sex marriage. Because if there's a constitutional right to marry, which is what the court has said in the past, then does that extend to couples who are of the same sex? And the second question is, if there isn't that constitutional right to marry for same-sex couples, do those states that do not recognize same-sex marriage in their own state, do they nonetheless have to recognize the legitimacy and the legality and the marriage status of those couples who marry in states where it is legal? And that would be, at the moment, about 37 states. So those are the two questions. I do have to say that when this was argued before the court, and it was a very long argument, it was 2.5 hours long, the second question, a lot of the air seemed to go out of the courtroom when that second question was argued. And I don't know what you take from that, but some people take from that that the court was really mainly focused on the first question. And, you know, you would have to say that if you were an odds maker in this case, and I never like to predict these cases, and that's stood me in very good stead for my whole life, but there is a procedural matter that happened this year, which is that the court refused to review lower court decisions striking down bans on same-sex marriage in many places in the country, some of them some of the most conservative places in the country. And so it let stand those lower court decisions, meaning that same-sex marriage became legal in those states for thousands and thousands of people who got married. And then finally, there was a court that ruled differently, an appellate court that ruled differently, and the court had to resolve the conflict. But it didn't stay. It didn't postpone or block those earlier court rulings saying, well, we're going to wait and see if there's going to be any different ruling. They now have on their plate 37 states, most of them through court decisions, where same-sex marriage is legal. And I don't know how you roll the clock back. That's the problem, practical problem, that in some ways the court would face. And it's hard to imagine that the justices didn't think about that at the time that they decided not to review those decisions upholding the right to marry for same-sex couples.
Is this going to be, when the decision comes out, cut and dried one way or another? Either same-sex marriage is legal or it's not? Or is this one of those cases where how the opinion is written, the scope of the decision, could be important for what the states can do going forward?
Well, certainly the scope of any decision is important because it may resolve questions more than marriage, or it may not. But I don't see any way that you can divide this one in half. Either there is the right to marry for same-sex couples in every state in the union, or there isn't. And then the fallback position is, well, okay, if there's not, then even the states where it's not legal, those states are going to have to possibly would have to recognize the states where it is legal. That in itself is the fallback position. So that's why you have the second question argued.
This is Friday. We are speaking on Friday afternoon. Just yesterday, Governor Rick Snyder here in Michigan signed a law which says that faith-based adoption agencies don't have to help a same-sex couple with adopting children. Could laws like that one be the next wave of cases that end up working their way up to the Supreme Court, especially if the court does rule that same-sex marriage is legal throughout the country?
Well, that one in particular might be one, but then you can have permutations on that. Supposing the faith-based agency gets state support, financial support, that changes the equation yet again. That's certainly possible, but there are lots of adoption agencies who are not faith-based. So that's certainly one of the ideas. I'm sure there are some states. I think it's in North Carolina this week that the state legislature overrode the governor's veto and therefore put into effect a law that said that county clerks or whoever gives out marriage licenses don't have to do it if in good conscience it violates their conscience. You know, whether a law like that could stand, I don't know, but I'm sure that there's going to be some test of laws like that. And then I think much more likely are the laws that may try to curtail who has to provide public services. So a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker, so to speak, and people go to a store that's otherwise open to the public and they're rejected because they're gay. That kind of a law might well be tested and make its way to the Supreme Court. So far, the court has declined to hear those cases and has, by inference, but certainly not by court decree, refused to allow those practices to take place. That, by those practices, I mean those, for want of a better expression, discriminatory practices take place.
You reported on the justices' previous statements and actions regarding same-sex marriage, which includes striking down the Defense of Marriage Act in 2013. Legally, how big a leap is it from striking down DOMA to saying that states cannot ban same-sex marriage?
Well, obviously, it wasn't that big a leap because something like 30 federal courts decided that the Supreme Court had sent a clear message when it struck down the Defense of Marriage Act that marriage between two people is protected by the Constitution, even if they're of the same sex. Having said that, though, there are people who in the federal courts who don't agree with that. They're very few. But Justice Scalia in dissent, when they struck down DOMA, Justice Scalia in dissent said, you know, essentially, you are sending a clear message that what you're going to do here next is uphold the right to same-sex marriage. And most of the federal courts who then had to rule on it heard the decision and they heard that dissent and they agreed with Scalia and they went ahead and did exactly what Scalia forecast that they were going to do.
Nina Totenberg, thank you very much for your time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Nina Totenberg is legal affairs correspondent for NPR. She joined us from Washington, D.C. Links to Nina Totenberg's reporting on this year's Supreme Court term can be found at WMUK.org.
You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Coming up, I speak to Donna Odom, Executive Director of the Southwest Michigan Black Heritage Society, about how its increased focus on racial healing is leading to a mission and name change. The Black Heritage Society is being renamed to SHARE. That's an acronym for Society for History and Racial Equity. Donna Odom talks to me about why the organization was begun 12 years ago and how it has evolved. The Black Heritage Society will roll out its new name on June 17th when it sponsors its Building a Racial Equity Network discussion. That's where representatives from a variety of anti-racism groups will talk about what they each do. When was the Southwest Michigan Black Heritage Society formed and what was the reason for that?
We formed it in 2003, and at that time I was still working at the Kalamazoo Valley Museum, and I had been given an assignment to do a project on the Underground Railroad. And in doing that project, I realized the rich history that Kalamazoo and Kalamazoo County, Southwest Michigan, had as far as African American history was concerned, and I thought, you know, we really need to have an organization that traces that history and really makes the community aware of the contributions that African Americans have made in the community. So I, you know, formed a group of people who were of like mind, and we started the organization. We became a 501c3 in 2003.
And so you operated for about 7 years while you were still at the museum, mm-hmm. and where you coordinated history programs and special projects. And I recall that Underground Railroad stuff that you did. You actually had a summer camp that exposed kids to that.
Right.
Now, in 2010, you retired from the museum. And tell me what happened then in terms of your organization and the kinds of work you were involved in.
Right.
I know that there was actually around the time that you retired, there was a huge race exhibit
right.
that was coming to the Kalamazoo Valley Museum.
Right.
Tell me about your role, because it all kind of intersects.
When we brought the exhibit to the museum, the planning began, obviously, well ahead of that time. And as you said, it came in 2010, but before that, we had been planning it at the museum. And in the community, an initiative formed around that exhibit. You know, we brought together over 30 organizations who were going to be involved in the race exhibit initiative. Now, I was assigned from the museum to work with, you know, helping to get the exhibit up and that kind of thing. But I was also assigned to be part of that initiative.
Yeah, part of that steering committee
right.
that operated
right.
in the community. I know that you had community discussions that I think you helped facilitate. How did this affect the work with your organization?
Right. We decided at that point that we
and that would be around the year 2010
some,
when
right,
the exhibit
right,
came
right, right.
for a few months. And it was a major touring exhibit about race.
Yeah. And we decided at that point that we should become involved as an organization and provide the historical background for, you know, for the exhibit. So we did a couple of things. One of them was to partner with Western Michigan University Journalism Department to put together an oral history project called Telling the Kalamazoo Community Race Story. And we published a book from that. But we also decided to bring the film Traces of the Trade and to invite the author of the companion book, Inheriting the Trade, Tom DeWolf, here in a program. And so we You know, we had Tom come in, he introduced the program and talked about his book. And if, for those who are not familiar with Traces of the Trade, it's about a Rhode Island family that actually were the one of the largest slave holders families in the country.
Right, and he's a descendant of that family.
He's a descendant of that family, and he and his cousins actually took the entire triangular journey that is, you know, that was part of the slave trade, and documented that. And then as a follow-up, he wrote the book, Inheriting the Trade.
And kind of giving a little bit of the backstory for our listeners who may not know and kind of following the timeline, again, that race exhibit came to the Kalamazoo area, the Kalamazoo Valley Museum, in fall of 2010. It left in early January and around of 2011. And by March, to keep that dialogue going about race, because it really did kind of get the community really talking about issues of race, you wanted to keep that dialogue going. So you actually helped form something called the Race Initiative Book Club.
Right.
And what's different about that book club, and you know, full disclosure, I'm actually a founding member of that group.
Yes,
with you. The book club meets in community spaces and brings people of various races together to talk about books concerning race. You're looking now to change the name of your organization. It's now going to be called SHARE, the acronym SHARE, and that stands for?
Society for History and Racial Equity.
Why now the name change?
Right. Well, we've been working up to that point, obviously.
Definitely.
In 2012, we decided, again, this is an extension of the race exhibit, we decided to put together a race initiative. And as a kickoff for that, we invited Tom DeWolf back, he and his writing partner, Sharon Morgan, who had written the book Gather at the Table. And both Tom and Sharon are members of a group called Gather at the Table. And what it is descendants of both slave holders and people, you know, who were enslaved, their descendants. And they come together for racial healing. And so they put together the book, traveling all over the country, visiting various venues, and really getting to know one another, a little, you know, going beyond just sitting at a table and discussing issues of race. They really got to know one another. And the book reflects that, of course. Anyway, they came here in 2012 and spoke. That was our kickoff for the Race Initiative, which was originally a two-year initiative. In 2014, at the end of that two-year initiative, at our strategic planning, we realized that, you know, the activities involved with the race initiative had really become a major part of what we were doing. And we decided that we would actually make racial equity part of our mission. So, you know, we now formed a new mission statement, which is to nurture respect, to foster racial healing, and to promote appreciation and study of the African-American heritage and contributions to Southwest Michigan history. So that has become a part of our mission, and we've realized, of course, that our name did not reflect that new mission. So we came upon the idea of SHARE, Society for History and Racial Equity, and we're delighted to now have an acronym that we can use.
Also, in recent years, your organization has taken on sponsoring the annual Summit on Racism.
Correct.
And more recently, you did something hoping to bring in a youth voice to that. You did the kind of, I think it's a youth summit on racism, I believe is what you called it. So again, your work kind of turning more towards kind of this racial healing. There's another event you have coming up now on June 17th, and it is entitled Building a Racial Equity Network. What is that about?
That's the kind of a part of our community discussion series that we've been doing on a monthly basis. This is to bring together organizations and individuals who are engaged in activities that have to do with racial equity, but also to invite members of the community who would like to become involved in some way and acquaint them with the organizations that are doing this work. So it's a networking event as well as an opportunity for us to announce our new name and our new direction and that kind of thing. But one of the things that we want to do as a very important part of SHARE is to bring together people to collaborate and cooperate in racial equity efforts. We realize there are a lot of groups out there who are doing things, and we want people to know about them, and we want to support those groups. One of the things that we have realized, very, very important to our work, is collaboration. We never would have been able to do a lot of the things that we've done if we hadn't collaborated with other organizations. We're very small. We've always been very small. But we've been able to increase our capacity by working with other groups. So we want to kind of share that concept with other people. We're stronger together. There's just no way around that.
Tell me how you see with this new focus, or I should say this evolving focus, you've been doing this for some time, you're just now formalizing it with a name. How will your organization differ from others doing this kind of work? Like you said, there are others in the area. How will it differ?
What we want to do, as I said, is to kind of become a clearinghouse for all of those organizations. Our particular part that we play is to offer programs that promote racial healing. So we'll continue our retreats, we'll continue our community discussions, the book club, all of that. But there are other people out there who are doing different kinds of things, like anti-racism training and working for fair food and that sort of thing. So we want to collaborate with those organizations and to promote what they're doing as well. So we want to be kind of a clearinghouse where people who want to get involved can figure out, okay, where can I plug in? You know, am I just kind of getting my feet wet right now and maybe just, you know, wanting to come out to a book club and get educated, find out a little bit more about the history of racism? And once I find that out, maybe then I'll want to do, you know, something more active. So we want to give people that opportunity to find their place in what we call the continuum.
Something that I also kind of wanted to highlight is that it might be easy to think that the organization might just be you, but there's actually many people behind you. Represent a board, a governing board that has about 12 different members, and many of them are actually affiliated with major historical and other types of organizations. Can you tell us some of the names of some of those people people might recognize?
Yeah, I would first mention Romeo Phillips, who is a founding member. He was one of the first who was part of the organization. He's worked with us the entire time.
And is a former chairperson for you.
Yeah, and a former board chair. And is now an emeritus member, which means that, you know, he still has membership status, still is able to vote. But we realize, you know, he can't make every single thing and be there all of the time.
And people may recognize his name as a former Portage City Council member and first African-American tenured professor at Kalamazoo College. And he does a lot of stuff in the arts world, singing and so on. I think acting as well.
Yeah. So he's a well-known name in the community. Absolutely. And then, of course, we have director of the archives, Sharon Carlson, who is our secretary, obviously a great support for what we're doing in the history, in the area of history, and Christine Barrow, who is the retired director of Portage Library. So those two, have been a great help and support, as we do our history and form our own archives.
Yeah, when you talk about archives, you're referring to Dr. Dr. Sharon Carlson, who's the director of Western Michigan University's Archives and Regional History Center here on campus. And you also have Judge Curtis Bell, who's also, I think, an emeritus member
Yes.
now. Yeah, so you have a number of individuals affiliated with your organization. Can you tell me a little bit about, you've evolved also in terms of staffing. Before, wasn't it like entirely volunteer run?
Right. Well, our major funding comes from the Kalamazoo Community Foundation, and they have been extremely supportive as we have evolved and helped us in many ways in, you know, forming our new look and our new direction. And at this point, I am actually, you know, able to have an assistant, Jacob Penny Johnson, who is a young man who is involved with a lot of activities in the community. He's worked with Erase, he's worked with the Fair Foods and that kind of thing. So he's a wonderful addition to our staff. And Dana Lindsay is our archivist, and she has done some study at Kalamazoo Valley Community College, and I think Western as well, taking some courses, and she her ambition is to be a full-time archivist at some point. So she is wonderful in organizing us and keeping our records straight and all of that. So I'm delighted to now be able to talk about having a real staff.
As you reflect over, gee, if your organization started in 2003, what would you say are the top accomplishments you've done over those years to present?
I'm really proud of the oral history projects that we've done. Because I think that those projects have really made a difference in the lives of the young people who have done those interviews with elders from the community. And, you know, and the publications that we have produced from those.
You're talking about the one with the racial healing? With the race exhibit, yes.
Yeah, telling the Kalamazoo community race story. And then we just published one recently. Engaging the Wisdom, which is part of the Racial Healing Initiative.
And that was published?
That's
oral history?
Yes, that was published as well.
When was that published?
Just last year, at
really?
The end of the year. Mm-hmm. I think just being able to collaborate with so many organizations in the community, it's really done so much for us. I think that just the ability to work with other people in that way and be successful in that way, I think is one of our major accomplishments. And, you know, I think that another accomplishment is just being able to bring together people. We have gotten, testimonials, you would call them, from people saying, you know, that they're so thankful that we've been doing some of the things that we've been doing. I mean, you know, when we started out with the idea of the Racial Healing Initiative, as I said, we thought it would be 2 years, but the reactions that we got from people, you know, wanting more, you know, always asking for more discussions, more time, we realized that it was something that was really needed very much in the community. And so that is why we decided to make that part of our mission. And I think that just education, you know, people just aren't aware of so many things. It's amazing to us. You know, we have people telling us they didn't know that slaves were whipped. You know, stuff like that. It's just obviously needed.
Last thoughts. Why is this issue of racial equity so important in America and in this community in particular?
Well, it's been important for many, many years, forever, I guess. I think the race issue is probably one of the most crucial issues in our history and in our current lives. I mean, you see it every day on television, you know. And part of the problem is that people have not spent enough time with one another to really know who that other person is. They see a white person or they see a black person. They don't see an individual. And I think that is the reason why the discussions and the retreats and the book club are meaningful to people, because we share our stories and we become human to one another. And I think that, you know, that all of the activist kinds of things that we do are extremely important, but we also have to do a lot of work on the individual level. And that's what we're trying to do.
You can learn more about the new mission and name of the Southwest Michigan Black Heritage Society at the informational program titled Building a Racial Equity Network. The program is open to the public and scheduled for 6 p.m. Wednesday, June 17th at the Kalamazoo Public Library's downtown branch. For more information, go to our webpage at wmuk.org. For WMUK's West Southwest, I'm Earlene McMichael.